You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, the Course for Speakers to Promote the Idea of Threefolding. It is Collected Works, Volume 338, translated by Rory Bradley. This is the second lecture in Part 2, which I am numbering Lecture 12, and the last lecture before the question and answer final section. This Lecture 12 was given in Stuttgart on January 2, 1921. I am sorry that we do not have more time to talk. Right now I can only present to you certain suggestions regarding our particular problem. This afternoon I will turn to the questions that you, friends, wish to pose. Yesterday I attempted, in the context of a certain historical sequence, to make clear to you the hopelessness that exists in regard to the question of Upper Silesia, in the context of present-day relationships. But this hopelessness can also appear to us from various other sides. It is the case now that people who continue to think with old presuppositions give themselves over to terrible illusions about the future of European life. Indeed, such people live exclusively on illusions. And those friends of ours who have resolved to work truly for the betterment of world relationships must make clear to themselves that within the masses we can make progress only in so far as we are able to bring about enlightenment, and relatively quickly. And not only enlightenment about local affairs, but enlightenment also about world relationships in general, which actually are playing into the relationships of the smallest territories now. We will not be able simply to build on the institutions that already exist. We must first have recourse only to those people who are inclined to take up our ideas, so that we have an ever greater number of such people. And then with these people we can really start something. And we must try to make it clear to these people that even within the context of present-day relationships, they must act in a way that is in keeping with the sense of our ideas. For you see, yesterday we established that from both the German and the Polish side, there is essentially no future, either in the old or the newly hoped-for relationships. We can also make it clear to ourselves that, on the other hand, this hopelessness also has other foundations. Obviously, Upper Silesia is integrated into all of European relations. What is unique about its position is that it has to make a decision about its fate in a particular manner. This must be considered. Wherever decisions are to be made at this time, the larger perspective must be factored in. Let us look for a moment at European relationships from a different perspective than we did yesterday. You see, economic relations in Europe are such that in Central and Eastern Europe, in regard to everything that has developed out of the old relationships, things are headed toward a rapid decline. We in Europe no longer work on the old economic foundations that are there, even less so when it comes to the political and spiritual foundations. The people who are concerning themselves now with public affairs have some picture of the terrible threat of this downfall, but their images of it are illusory. The main illusion that we see in the people of Central Europe, and in Eastern Europe the same is true, is that they believe an understanding with the Anglo-Saxon element, or with the West in general, is possible under the standards of the old relationships. But such an understanding is actually not possible, and a vote like this one on the question of Upper Silesia will always stumble on precisely the impossibility of such an understanding. It has to stumble upon this possibility. One cannot simply cast a ballot in these relationships currently being created by the statesmen and economists. What kind of imagination can someone have who even half thinks, and hardly anyone thinks even that much, what imagination can someone have for a possible rehabilitation of European economic conditions, among other things? It could be said that the first thing that would be possible would be a big loan of currency, a big advance that would come from America. You know, of course, such things are being talked about now. Major advances, credit, which could come only out of America, would be given to the Europeans, perhaps guaranteed by the independent states that want to consolidate themselves, and economic life could then be elevated by such a loan of currency. Europe could then buy raw materials and food, and perhaps in the course of 30, 40, or 50 years, European economic relationships would be improved. This imagination bespeaks a kind of half-thinking. There will never be any sort of administration in America that would be in a position to simply do away with the oppositions that exist within European relations. The nations of Europe are not in a position to offer sufficient guarantees, even if there were only small measures attached. And such small measures could never be under these conditions. Guarantees cannot be given that would really lead to a successful bettering of European economic relationships through a currency loan. This also shows the impossibility of furthering economic life because of currency differences. This is why the possibility is closed of achieving something in this manner. One could, nevertheless, go on thinking that it would be possible to approach individual people in the neutral countries, or the allied countries, or America, about extending credit, in good faith, to individual economic figures in the European nations. This action alone, within the context of current relationships, could move only within a very small frame. For the people in the neutral countries or among the allied powers who could be asked to extend that credit are so few in number that we cannot actually imagine any sort of improvement of European relations by this means. Thus do people fall into all kinds of illusions. They skip over any sort of middle step and think immediately about some sort of world economic organization which is somehow to develop out of the idea of folk economics. They think about how, in some sort of world state, all of economic life could be put under a political purview, so that the particular liabilities of the besieged countries would not come under consideration. Now, this is, of course, a terrible sort of utopia, but it is precisely this that has now cropped up in the world, as evidenced by the gathering in Geneva. And to place your hopes in such an association of the people, oriented as it is toward the economic side, is necessarily utopian at present. What is truly important now is that we look more deeply into the evolutionary forces of humanity, and that the attempt is then made to arrive at regulations that will really be able and required to help. Such regulations are to be won only through threefolding. As soon as you give yourself over to the illusion that something can be done without threefolding, then you are simply participating in the downfall. Just think for a moment about what it would mean if, for example, the Upper Silesians were to vote in favor of annexation by Germany. This would amount to nothing less than the Upper Silesian population's consigning its small territory to a larger territory, that if it continues to handle things as it has been doing, must soon fall into barbarianism. It cannot be a matter of allowing annexation by a territory that has not already shown itself to have overcome the old relationships. This has not been demonstrated by the decisive crises in Prussian Germany. In fact, quite the opposite has been shown. And so, we regard the facts of the matter in a simply objective manner. Annexation by Prussian Germany means consigning oneself to impossible circumstances. For you see, now we arrive at the other illusion, and we shall go into this further, which the best people on the side of the Allied powers allow themselves. There are people like Keynes, who has a certain following, and Norman Angell, who also has quite a large following. How do these people think? These people think that the Versailles Treaty must absolutely be revised, that we cannot get anywhere on the basis of the current treaty. But why do they think that? They think, quote, Europe was, before now, in economic exchange with the entire world. If Europe falls into barbarianism, then its economic life collapses. And with that, close quote, this is how these people think, particularly Norman Angell, continue quote, and with that the economic life not only of the Allied powers will collapse, close quote, it goes without saying that that will collapse, continue quote, but also the American economic life, because the places for export to Europe will no longer be there. We need the economic countries for both sides of the Allied powers and America in order to be able to enter into fruitful economic exchange, close quote. You see, on this basis, the best people of the Allied powers make their judgments. You could say that actually in the last few months, several very significant things have been said along these lines, and that the number of people is steadily growing who are convinced of the non-viability of the Versailles Treaty and all that results from it. But they are wrong and live in an illusion. They make their judgments out of the existing habits of thought and feeling. We must not retreat fearfully from gruesome realities. It is simply untrue that the Anglo-Saxon world is dependent upon being in economic exchange with Central and Eastern Europe. At the very most, they would have to reorganize their whole economic life and turn it into a closed and contained economic body. They could then go on existing, even if a great number of people died of hunger in Europe. What people are saying is well-intentioned, but not true. It would take perhaps 15 to 30 years before the economic life in countries outside of Central and Eastern Europe could be reorganized so that it was entirely self-sufficient. But the real possibility for such a reorganization is there. If one were actually in a position to carry out what these people imagine, then whatever was done out of the old preconditions in Central and Eastern Europe would have to lead ultimately to the enhancement of the West via a detour through barbarianism. On the basis of old preconditions, nothing else can be imagined. It is possible to imagine that a majority might exist, namely in America, who would simply work to leave Europe to its fasting and make the western regions of the world into a self-contained economic area. But voting to join with the current conditions in Central Europe would be the same as running toward this condition. By joining with Poland, you would be doing no less. All that has just been said takes away any hope. You would also be doing no less than giving yourself over to the Allied powers' way of thinking. Poland is the little fosterling of the Allied powers. But in all of the instances where it matters, this will do nothing to help it. It will either be delivered to the ruins of European relationships, or it will be thrust into the catastrophic experiences that I will soon describe. So a vote in either direction is a patent absurdity. We must hold this matter up clearly before our souls. A vote like this is an absurdity. Still, we will speak about the conditions under which it might go in one direction or the other. We must nevertheless be clear that the world cannot be preserved with thoughts that were thought in the past. This can be shown most clearly in what I tried to describe yesterday. Poland, I said, has maintained what the rest of Europe has overcome, to a certain degree, a form of noble class. Beneath this noble class, a lower class has developed that has gained its impulse towards sanity and activism. I would suggest through a threefolding. That is, it took from Russia the spiritual, from Prussian Germany the economic, and from Austria via Galicia the rights political. This lower class has lived mostly within the bourgeois stream that has had the upper hand in Europe for a while now. So the things that have formed in Poland through a combination of the lower class and what came from the rest of Europe have now worked their way into the bourgeoisie. But its effectiveness is currently lackluster, just as the bourgeoisie in general is lackluster. Now there is simply this broad foundation, and this broad foundation comes toward us as a true simulacrum, as a likeness of the real. In the West, it comes out more as a worker movement gone bourgeois. In Central Europe, as a more or less nuanced form of social democracy. And the farther east we go, the more it presents itself as a form of Bolshevism. The life conditions of Bolshevism in Russia, we must make these clear to ourselves. After all, the Silesian region currently in question lies very close to the life conditions of Bolshevism. And we must bring a real and full clarity about these Bolshevist living conditions. You see, the basis of Bolshevism is that the upper class, whether it be the aristocracy or the bourgeoisie, has found no possibility in recent times of extending its thinking beyond the same regions into which labor, and above all human will, have extended themselves. People have continued working with the old way of thinking, have built up the commercial, the economic element, have drawn upon a whole mass of the population. But no steps have been taken to attend to this mass of the population by any means other than the old state relationships. And unfortunately, it must be said that this still is not happening today, because the one way in which it could actually happen is not happening. This must be our primary concern. For it is a characteristic example of how leaders were brought to bear upon a situation when things were actually moving and stirring within the masses of the population. It was not well done. Ludendorff explains in his recollections that he was the one who called up the Bolshevist leaders in Russia. He says that it was a military necessity for him, and the politicians were consequently obligated to ward off the terrible results of this necessity. So he does not deny that he gave Bolshevism in Russia its leaders. He merely says that the politicians were not clever enough to repair the tremendously foolish thing that he had done. Such things are possible these days, and they are tolerated. So out of the very oldest forms of state relationships, which was how Ludendorff thought, the leading individuals were appointed to Bolshevism, not out of a sensible cooperation between people who know something about the course of humanity, nor those who would actually want to lead toward new relationships, and not just lead with the old relationships. This is something that must be recognized at the most fundamental level. Since the World War, it is no longer true that the broad lower class is made up only of the old proletariat. All members of previous classes belong to this wide-reaching lower class. And people are not reckoning with this fact either. People are not reckoning with the idea that, above all else, rational ideas must be brought to those who have retained some intelligence from the time prior to the war, so that a leading intelligence comes ever more into the world in a reasonable manner. This is the most important issue for this time, that the people who have maintained something of their intelligence have their eyes opened so that they can become the true leaders. Without this, we will not move forward. Will you see what stands before us? As I have already mentioned, the reconstruction of Central and Eastern Europe is not possible except on a foundation of threefolding. It cannot be done by the people of Central and Eastern Europe, nor by the people of the Allied powers. The people from the Allied powers and America could do something under only one condition, whether we are talking about the extension of a large-scale loan or small-scale credit. They can do this under only one condition, namely that a significant wage push take place in Europe over and against America. The American proletariat would be immediately against this, and the English proletariat also might not allow it. Any measure taken in this direction would lead to revolution in the Western regions. And this is precisely what must be made a part of humanity's outlook, that the Bolshevist revolution has also gripped the Western world, not yet from without, but from within the broad lower class. The leading individuals in the West can construct as many barriers as they like against the Bolshevist contamination of the West. But the transmission of Bolshevism from the East is not the main issue for the West. Rather, its main concern, the core of the matter, is what is coming up from below. Now, there are already a number of people, and this number will quickly grow, who see that it is entirely impossible to avoid revolution if one continues to work out of an ethos. And just as people who were thinking in that old way said, quote, "We must have a war in order to conquer the revolution in our own country," close quote. This means nothing less than that among the people in the West who are still thinking in an old way, work must be being done toward a Second World War. There is no other way to turn away from the inner Bolshevism of the West except to work toward a Second World War. The approach of this Second World War is made all the more certain by the fact that in the East, as soon as things came to a head, an understanding could never be won for the economic standards of the West. The way of thinking that has come forward now in Russia is even connected in the East with Eastern religious imaginations. And so an ethos has developed in Asia, to whose direction the Japanese population and its leaders are unusually well suited, so that the division between East and West will soon fall into the economic confusions of the future. A Second World War, which must develop between Asia and America, and what lies between them, will doubtless develop entirely out of an economic underpinning. You all hear the cry that rises up from the lower classes, quote, "World Revolution," close quote. It will be possible to disguise these thoughts of world revolution only by unleashing the storm of a Second World War. It is otherwise unthinkable. We now find ourselves living in a time in which the conflict between America and Asia is growing ever starker. It goes without saying that the people who lie in the middle will be pulled into this conflict. You can be quite sure that Asia, with the Japanese at the head, will be in the same position over and against the West that Central Europe was against the Allied powers. In the East, they will perhaps give themselves over to a feeling of confidence about their victory for a time, but just as America was a deciding factor in Europe, so will it also be a deciding factor in Asia. But there will be a Ludendorff in the East who will send the necessary leaders to the West in order to contaminate it with a Bolshevist, or in this case Asian, element. There will be one among the Japanese as well. And then you will have the very thing toward which everyone's sentiments are directed right now. You will have brought it about through a Second World War. We must imagine an America in which a Lenin is practicing economics, just as Lenin is doing in Russia right now. We must not close ourselves off from this perspective. We must be clear that the causes of the present urgency lie in economic downfall, that the effects lie in the barbarization of humanity. To this we can only present one single counterbalancing fact, which may perhaps be said here in connection to these things. It must also penetrate throughout all of our work, while also not being made into material for an agitation. For in the moment that it is made into something like that, it will immediately be destroyed within this world historical moment. You see, all over the world there are people who, because they have reached an end with the present-day economic, political, and spiritual thought, have simply begun to consider this idea of threefolding. The things that have arisen in reaction to the translation of title Toward Social Renewal into English are an indication of a fully legitimate proof of this. If we are able to make use of the fact that Toward Social Renewal is being discussed in English newspapers, if we could be strong enough to make an appropriate impact, then we will, for as long as the trail is warm, be able to develop a very effective agitation. But the place where we fail is having a sufficient number of individuals who can work effectively for our cause. This led to my indicating, back in the spring of 1920, that we would need to have 50 people here in Stuttgart who could discuss with me and with each other what is necessary in order for this to be brought to people. So, here we are, today. There is no other way than to enlighten a great number of people. But for this, a sufficient number of enlightened people are necessary, who speak from the foundations of the matter. For you can be sure, if you present the things that we have discussed today and yesterday, they will have an effect. It need only be brought to a sufficient number of people. It will not be enough for us to spread out with just 10 people. Rather, we must fan out into the world with hundreds of activists. This is necessary, that we always have more and more individuals involved. So, as I said, from out of the lower class rises an understanding in opposition to barbarianism the world over. Leaders must be there, leaders who can understand what lies within the threefold social organism by way of their inner qualities. These leaders can exist only in Central Europe. This is the paradox that stands before humanity now, that in those regions that are most opposed, the most besieged, nevertheless live the people who are most able to understand the way out from the confusions of humanity. In this regard, we in Central Europe have been tested well enough. Just think, since the first half of the 19th century, the thought of an organization of the German people built primarily on ideals has emanated from the best qualities of that German populace. What manifested itself as a striving for unity, particularly since 1848, came out of the most beautiful qualities of the German population in Central Europe. It was essentially a precious stone in the cultural evolution of humanity. And it has a particular quality about it that must be called upon. It has the quality that will not allow it to be held in contempt, not be hated by any population on earth, but rather accepted by everyone. Even the Poles would accept it if it were to appear with the quality that it once did as a political idea in Germany. Among those people who later, in so-called realist Germany, were mocked as the, quote, idealists of 48, close quote, there were basically a few who best brought certain qualities to expression. Everything that has come onto the scene in the last few decades in Central Europe, in Austria as well as Germany, has been in opposition to that. It was later that things developed that at the most basic level contradict the German being. And these are the things that are hated by the whole world, that the whole world is complaining about. As long as Central Europe does not see that it has to work out of foundations that are in the spiritual realm, that it cannot base its historical mission entirely on power relationships, but only on the spiritual, then there will not be an impulse for any sort of evolved Central Europe, but ultimately only an impulse toward the downfall of the whole civilized world. In this regard, we can actually look back to Fichte. I will draw attention to only 2 points in Fichte, to the last words that he said in his title Speech to the German Nation, in which he called upon the Germans to remember their own qualities, to work out of what lies within them, because this will allow them to look from a higher point of view at the world. And on the other hand, he admonished them to relinquish their claim on sea power. Go and read in the, quote, Speech to the German Nation, close quote, how strongly Fichte advised against striving after any sort of sea power. Fichte mocked the so-called freedom of the seas. This came out of a deep-seated instinct. And you see, the moment we touch upon these things, we must simultaneously be made aware that here is the lever that can reverse things. Go and read the important section, which was not understood at the time, just as the whole book was not understood, the important section that I tried to offer in my, quote, title, Thoughts During the Time of War. That is, that the German populace is not guilty of the war. Read that section, and then read the caption on the cover, which says that the book is intended for Germans, and for those people who do not believe that they must hate them. For I knew well that this could be understood only by certain people. But there were no people like that at the time, even though I was asked to put out a second edition of the book. I refrained from doing so, because basically the only people who were taking it were the ones who believed that they had to hate the Germans. In Germany, people nearly kept, neatly kept silent about these matters. The book could really have meant something only if someone had taken it up fully in all its factual foundation. And so it had to be taken out of bookstores. Within the circle of people who were Germans or who did not think it was required to hate the Germans, I wanted to call forth a certain feeling that existed in their depths of soul. If this feeling, as it was intended at that time, had really come out into the open, it would have established an atmosphere. That means that if people had been able to see externally that such a feeling existed, then it would have led to something good. If people were to perceive such a sentiment now, it would still lead to something positive. Allow me now to say the following. I ask you to consider the words that I will now read to you precisely in connection with what we are currently discussing. Quote, "The German people did not compel their government into the war. They knew nothing about it in advance and did not agree with it. We do not want to attach responsibility to the German people, who have also suffered sorrows in this war for which they were not the cause." Close quote. So now I ask you, does this not accord perfectly with what I expressed during the war in that little book titled Thoughts During the Time of War? But who, under the influence of certain other people, said these words on June 14, 1917? It was Woodrow Wilson. If this matter is properly conceived, then the possibility for an understanding throughout the world lies within it. We must think about this turn of phrase. Even today we must think that in the moment when something was actualized in Europe that proved to be dealing solely with the genuine evolution of humanity, and proved not to be dealing at all with a collection of old things, we must realize that in that moment a common understanding with the world can be found coming out of Central Europe. In the moment when, even if only on a limited scale, an appeal can be made at some point to the self-determination of people in Central Europe, it must be shown that the German being, when it truly comes out of itself, does not want to have any connection to the old forms of power. This is regardless of whether the old forms are old statesmen or industrialists, and regardless of whether they stand on the side of Helfferich or Erzberger, or on the side of German democracy. Everything that has a connection with what came to the surface for the first time in the Wilhelmine period must be discarded. And we must find what can be said within the true foundations of the German being, to which the Austrian being also belongs. But then, what is said will be in accord with what is said by others the world over who still have some sense of reality. It would make an enormous impression upon the world if some small group were to say, quote, "We want nothing to do with Prussia in the form that it has taken on. We want nothing to do with everything that stands under the protection of the Allied powers. We know that wholly other forces can come forth from our foundations. We want to orient ourselves toward threefolding. We do not want to have only a pseudo-autonomy as it has come forward. We want a genuine, a true autonomy, and will establish ourselves provisionally within this true and genuine autonomy. We will transform the vote into a protest against the fact of the vote." Close quote. This is the necessary consequence that results from the facts of history as well as those of present-day international affairs. Certainly one can respond by saying, quote, "The result of something like this today would be that you place yourself on the earth between two chairs." Close quote. This will not be the result if it can be popularized sufficiently and fast enough, that it becomes at the very least something clearly perceptible in the case of the vote in Upper Silesia. Only by way of such things can we make progress in our movement. The one thing that stands against us is that we are not in a position to get far enough before the day of the vote to actually realize the kind of protest that should stand against the fact of the vote as such. Then any work on this region will become especially complicated. For those who promulgate our ideas will not find a foothold in Prussian Germany any more easily than they did in Poland. And so they actually have nothing to lose that they would not lose anyway, regardless of whether one result or the other comes about. The only possibility for any success in this matter is if a sufficiently large number of people launch this protest out into the world. Even today, this protest would be as effective as if Kuhlmann had simply stood up at the proper time before the German Reichstag and presented the whole threefolding prospectus against the ideas of Wilson. For in the future, it will not be a matter of achieving compromised victories, but rather of standing stalwartly for something of meaning that you have taken from the matter for itself. And if it would only happen, fostered by the fact of this vote, that a relatively small number of people, it really needs to be, of course, thousands, cried out into the world, quote, "We as Upper Silesians see that it is absurd to annex to one side or the other," close quote. People would hear that throughout the world. It would become a factor throughout the world, because it would have been generated by the fact that it was connected to this vote. We must strive to publish what we have to say week after week in something like the journal titled The Threefold Social Organism, where it can be as full of spirit as possible. However, it will be circulated only through decreasing inward-flowing waves. We must also see to it that wherever something important is happening in the world, the threefolding movement has a voice, that it does not simply stand on the sidelines of world events, but rather seeks the moments in which something can really be done, because humanity is simply hypnotized by the other things that are happening. Do you believe the Allied powers will take notice of the threefold movement if we do nothing but circulate threefolding here in theory? No, their eyes are hypnotized by things like the Upper Silesia vote. What thousands of people say in connection to such things will help the others see what they would otherwise overlook. These are the things that we must pay particular attention to in the present moment here. Of course, should it not be possible to win over a sufficiently large number of people, then under the present circumstances, there is nothing left but for our friends to say, quote, "Someday the threefold movement will indeed move beyond its birth pangs into reality, and within the German population, perhaps of necessity, an understanding for threefolding will develop. And so we will vote provisionally for annexation by Prussian Germany, in the hope, however, that this Prussia will fall away." Close quote. But this is only a surrogate solution, and to it we would then append the conditions under which we suffer. What we must look toward is winning people to our cause who can be active within our movement, who can be active in the sense of our threefold movement. And in this regard, and we cannot keep silent about this, we have not been working with enough force or effectiveness. Currently, we are lacking supporters who can do work in every region where we need them. The people that we do have are certainly energetic workers, but actually there must be such people everywhere. They would perhaps need a 36-hour day, if not a 64-hour day or more. The few people within our ranks who do effective work are aware of this. We need more and more people. And if we succeed in getting more and more people, then we will indeed arrive at an advancement of the threefold movement in Central Europe, one with which something can really be done. But we should not let such an auspicious moment pass by unutilized, in which we could really show the world what threefolding is all about. The world would concern itself with threefolding if we could make use of it, if the things that the Upper Silesian task signifies for us were known. The world would concern itself to an unprecedented degree with the threefold movement, and we must bring this about, for without it we will not get anywhere in the future. This is what must be especially emphasized by those who have now taken it upon themselves to campaign for our concerns within the Upper Silesian population. This is what they must inscribe upon their hearts. We cannot say that the threefold movement should, in general, be expanded, because this is impossible right at the beginning. You see, with the threefold movement in the background, I had once, during the so-called World War, brought things about in such a way that someone was campaigning heavily for the establishment of an organized news service in Zurich during the war. I was able to make it clear to someone that nothing could be accomplished on the basis of the old press relationships. The matter had progressed so far that on a Tuesday, I have had to relate this story again and again, I was told, quote, "It appears to be very likely that in the next few days you will be able to relocate to Zurich to set up the news service," close quote. But on the next day, the refusal came from the headquarters, which was indeed all-powerful, advising me that so many people in Germany were waiting on such a post that it could not really be earmarked for an Austrian. Now, we need only to think about such things in order to get a feeling for how all of the words that were once spoken out of the idealism of our time no longer have any meaning, for how we must look at things when they become clear to us in the light of the threefold movement. If only the call could somehow sound in the way I have described, then things would happen. You see, you must be clear about the fact that until now the hindrance to a furthering of humanity that is now going forward consisted of the fact that the actual spiritual movement was for many long centuries bound up in external power relationships, in external constellations. Just think about the fact that the whole step forward of the bourgeoisie, and, along with this, everything that we achieve in our arts and sciences, that all this was basically connected with the formation of the nation-states. That is, it was because the states were leading that the whole upsurge of the last centuries took place. Finally, people are in a position to no longer take what comes from the states as the directive force. They turn toward the old state, which is now supposed to lead. This old state will fail, regardless of whether it is undercut by social democracy. Bolshevism or some intellectual group or another will always fail the peasants of the world. Very interesting studies of this can be made in Switzerland. For example, in Switzerland, when the people were very near to a revolution, it was the peasants who fought against it. The Swiss have only the peasants to thank for the fact that the impending revolution did not break out. Here we have quite clearly the opposition between the general peasantry and what arises in individual cultural classes. These were the states, this was the state, and so forth. Only in Russia did the matter turn out differently. The 600,000 people who are now in the throes of the Bolshevist birth pains in Russia are not the ones who brought this about. What has arranged for this situation is that the whole mass of the peasantry dotes upon Lenin, and that this mass believes that they have some hope of receiving land. This peasantry believes that only if Lenin stays will things be completed in such a manner. If Lenin falls, then they will not get their land. What is the one single solution within this great cultural question lying in humanity's future? Naturally, this culture is dependent on there being spiritual leaders present. We can formulate it thus. Until now, these spiritual leaders had to look back to particular power constellations, back to the villages, back then to the cities, had to look back to the being of the state, because there was no sentiment present for creating a kind of organization that by way of its very recognition would be directive in and of itself. And this is the possibility for allowing the sources of high culture to realize themselves, creating such an organization, independent from all other social constitutions. And between this spiritual organism and the broad economic organism, the Reich's political organism would stand, just as the rhythmic circulatory system stands between the nervous system and the metabolic system. The only solution to the question of the future is the establishment of a spiritual life that will work directly through itself. You can see work that has been done on this in my book titled Toward Social Renewal. Only the creation of this spiritual organism will lead us forward. In the moment that we allow ourselves to fall backward by pleading for the creation of a spiritual aristocracy, we do not understand the matter at hand. The Catholic Church, when it is commensurate with the old relationships, is finally just such an organization. It is independent from the state organization, and so on. But it no longer has a mission. Its mission is done. The fact that it can be organized into such a large pseudo-power lies in the independence of the institution from external power relationships. To that end, such a spiritual organization, independent of everything except itself, must be created. Understanding of this must be awakened in people. And if we find the right way of doing it, this understanding can be awakened, for it is no longer the pre-war proletariat alone that makes up the wide-reaching lower class. Rather, other classes have already been forced down into it, and our present task is to win them over, paying no regard to their class standing, but not by preaching our ideas. Instead, when there are concrete matters to attend to, we must handle them in accordance with those ideas. The end of Lecture 12, which is Lecture 2 and Part 2 of the book Communicating Anthroposophy. The last one, which will be numbered number 13, will be a question and answer session. So this is the end of Lecture 12.